Well, good evening and good morning, EPL State of Mind listeners. It is another wonderful day and evening for us here at the studio with myself, James, Kyle, and Sean. We have another very interesting episode, one that we probably could have predicted last week based off results of this week, but we have a very interesting nonetheless one in store for you today that features stoppage time winners galore throughout the weekend, gold making its way to the Premier League, a spirited showdown at the Emirates, which Sean and I highlighted last week and had our friendship tested, not so much this time, and our first sacking of the season. So as always, the first sacking does ring El Saco. So get ready to talk about that. Prepare for that and much, much more as we delve back into the world of the EPL State of Mind. Well, welcome back, Sean. Welcome back, Kyle. How are you guys doing today?
I feel like we got spoiled. We have so many good games to go over, and they don't even pale to comparison with the games we got next week. I don't think there's a single bad game of soccer or football on next week. This should be unbelievable for the world of soccer.
I'm very excited for this weekend's games, especially coming off of a game that we'll go over this week. Obviously, the Jets and the Giants. The Giants play tonight. The Jets, sorry, Sean. The Mets, sorry, Kyle and Sean. And then the Yankees, sorry to me. But we'll see if the Yankees can pull something out of a hat tonight against the Dodgers here in NYC. So in the EPL State of Mind hometown. But that is a completely different sport. And I know that Ian, Brendan Heasley, Mike, Matt, and the rest of the Red Devils fan base on this podcast are just dying to hear what we have to say today, because some of the biggest news that we've been talking about for, it feels like, the past two seasons already has finally come to a head. Mount Etna has erupted. The volcanoes across the globe are no longer dormant. The bald cap is off. It is Erik ten Hag's sacking, and no other person in the tri-state area can probably dive into coaching and gafferism as much as our golden gaffer boy, Sean Larkin. Sean, I feel like we've been talking about this forever. This summer, Manchester United, with Enos at the helm, decided to extend Erik ten Hag's contract. I think this can be considered one of their biggest first blunders as new ownership. What's going on here, man? Or what happened finally?
As you said, I think it was just a matter of time. Like we talked about this for months. I mean, we were talking about him not being fit for the job probably a year ago, maybe more, when we brought on Brendan and Mike. And Erik ten Hag's done nothing but prove us right since then. They came to a head, like you said, this week with a loss to West Ham in stoppage time. They also had a draw in midweek against Fenerbahce, but they've had four wins in their 13 competitions this season. There's some good and some bad, and I think he's experienced both the highs and lows of being the Manchester United manager. He ended their six-year trophy drought with that League Cup victory last year. Then he also had the FA Cup victory, which saved his job temporarily against Manchester City. But they had their worst ever Premier League finish last year, finishing eighth, a negative three goal differential, and they're off to a terrible start this year. As I said, three draws in Europe, currently in 14th place in the Premier League. There's so many damning statistics that just kind of summarize how much of a disappointment he's been since a very promising first year when he got top four. And I'll throw it over to Kyle to kind of run through some of those with you guys.
Oh, that's so kind of you, because I am going to thoroughly enjoy this next segment. All right, so as Sean did say, there are some damning statistics for the Ten Hag era. We'll start with Manchester United scored 123 goals in his entire tenure. That's 85 games, and that's 10th in the Premier League, tied with Fulham. And they are coming off one win in their last 11 games of Europe. It's not a good look for him or the organization, and worst of all, here is the expected goal differential against the big clubs in England. Man City, 116.5. Arsenal, 98.4. Liverpool, 88. Tottenham, 26. Chelsea, 24. Newcastle, 22. Villa, 8. I mean, it's terrible. It's garbage. United, minus 3.4. Just negative. Overall, this was inevitable since the end of the last season when United were openly interviewing new managers, only to extend Ten Hag after the FA Cup upset victory over City, which was, in my opinion, the worst thing that could have happened for United. He wore that silverware around his neck every single interview, every loss. It was his biggest excuse. Oh, well, I don't see you holding silverware. Shut the fuck up. You are a terrible coach. And he should have been gone way long ago. I'm glad this is finally happening. There's a chance Manchester United finishes top 10.
Yeah. I think before we get into, obviously, the interim coach, that we kind of saw the writing on the walls, right? Manchester United brought in a prolific striker, a club legend, right? And it's Ruud van Nistelrooy. He takes over at the interim coach for now while they wait for the final notification or final award to the Sporting Lisbon coach, right? But in general, you know, with Aaron Ten Hag, why don't we take a look at the newer coaches in the league, right? So Unai Emery used to coach for Arsenal, wasn't cutting it for Arsenal, left, came back, and is now one of our league's greater coaches. We can look at Thomas Frank with Brentford. Obviously not in the top four position, but his team has identity, right? Eddie Howe, he's coming in with Newcastle United, has an identity. I think we can generally say that Eric Ten Hag, as a Manchester United coach, never gave the team an identity. And if you aren't able to find that identity and build off of that, or at least build off of a core group of people that, yeah, you can argue that weren't healthy all the time, but you go through injuries and you can still have an identity and you coach everyone around that to conform to said identity, it's a problem. Yes, and he hasn't been in any other greater league, right? He was in the Netherlands league, you know, which no shame on that. He did well there with Ajax, but it's not the Premier League. It's not La Liga. It's not Serie A. It's not even, you know, Ligue 1, which is not that great anymore, but he's not coming from a real reputable place. He's coming from a world reputable team with Ajax, but still, Ajax, they had a system there. They didn't have any system here at Manchester United. He finishes below, obviously, in win percentages under Sir Alex Ferguson, who have at 110 matches had a 65% winning percentage. David Moyes is right there with him at 50%. Eric Ten Hag had 52%. Jose Mourinho had 54%. And then the only one that finished worse by a large margin was Ralf Rangnick. And he only had 24 games in that percentage. So to be honest with you, I think it's time to bring in someone new. We've been talking about for a while. And Sean, that new person is someone that Arsenal has played within the past 2 years and was eliminated in Europa from in penalty kick shootout in 2023. Can you tell us a little bit more about this coach?
Yes, it's Ruben Amorim, as you said, from Sporting Lisbon. Rumors came out today from David Ornstein that Manchester United were negotiating with him and will pay the 10 million euro release clause to get him out of his contract at Sporting. Taking a look at Amorim, what is he? How does he coach? That sort of thing. As our friend Nick Cartwright would say, he's a hot Portuguese guy. He's 39 years old. He's been the gaffer at Sporting for the last 4 years. They've won two league titles and two league cups in that time frame. Typically known for playing a 3-4-3 system with a very high defensive line and compacting and compressing the middle of the pitch. Very much a boa constrictor type of coach. He tries to give you no air to breathe. If you're going to progress centrally, you're going to have a tough day playing up against his squads. Where you can attack against them is on the wings and in those channel spaces, but still a very impressive coach. He coached the third best defense in Europe last year behind Arsenal and Feyenoord. Like I said, he's won the Portuguese league twice. And he has some experience working with a few of the guys at Manchester United. He barely worked with Bruno. Bruno left basically the summer that he came in at Sporting, but he has worked with new Manchester United signing Manuel Ugarte. He coached him for 3 seasons. And his role will be very, very important in the system that Amorim likes to play. He really relies on that defensive midfielder to shield the back three and clean up everything. They have to basically cover the entire width of the pitch from a defensive standpoint. He's also developed Premier League stars like João Paulinho, Pedro Porro, and now Matthias Nunez, who will debate whether or not he's a star, but he is at Manchester City, so he has to be pretty good. So this guy's player development, certainly a positive, something that we can't say the same for in his time at United for Erik ten Hag. Other than maybe Garnacho, I'm not sure how many players you would say, and Dalot, how many players you would say greatly improved from the Solskjaer and Rangnick reign into Ten Hag's. But I think overall,
maybe you could throw Kobe Manu in there, but that was more.
I think that's his own development. Yeah, that's more of his own development, and he's also stagnated compared to where he was at when he first burst onto the scene last year. I think his lack of pace is kind of caused issues, and he doesn't have a lot of athleticism around him to kind of compensate for that either. But it's an interesting hire if they do pull it off. I think it's probably the best guy available. My pick, if I could have gotten anybody, if I'm a Manchester United fan, would have been Thomas Tuchel, but he's not available anymore. So I think Amorim, it'll be interesting to see kind of how he meshes with that squad, because they struggled to have two fit center backs at one time. Now they'd be relying on having three fit center backs at a time. But I think overall he could get a lot more out of that team. And from the counterattacking standpoint that we saw under Solskjaer, they'll probably go a little bit more towards that in the short term. And then as he gets his guys in, build from there.
Yeah. I was going to ask how do the current players fit into this 3-4-3 system? You know, it's very difficult, especially, well, it's been a very costly tenure for Manchester United, for Erik ten Hag, right? They extended his contract, which means now they have to buy him out of his contract, right? So they can't just sack him and say, no, we're not going to pay you. You had a contract, which we extended, so now you got to pay more. And then you got to go ahead and you have to buy the new coach through potentially the release clause, which is more money up front. And then you got to give him a contract. So this is a costly, a lot of people don't realize when you go from coach to coach, it is very costly. And that's why coaches have such short contracts compared to players, right? Because it is more costly to get rid of your coach than it is to trade away a player. But it will be very interesting to see how the players that Ten Hag essentially have brought in, half of them from Bayern Munich and Ajax, is going to convert into this Portuguese playing style, which will be very interesting. So we'll keep an eye on that moving forward. But obviously, today marks one of the greatest, probably the greatest individual award ceremony and team award ceremony that you can, and it was the Ballon d'Or. So in Paris, we had the ceremony as per usual, and we had, unfortunately, I'll pass over Kyle because it was a Manchester City player who won, but not only does he play for Manchester City, he had a hell of a Euros with Spain, and we can all agree that he is probably the best defensive midfielder, and now we can probably agree that he is debatably the best player in the world based off this Ballon d'Or award, and that is one Rodri.
So Kyle,
congratulations.
Congratulations to Rodri. I mean, there were so many good players in this year's selection that I gotta be honest, I am a little surprised it was Rodri who won it. That being said, I am not upset about that. He is the first Spaniard to win the Ballon d'Or since Luis Suarez. Not that Luis Suarez, you fools. 1960, guys. Come on. Rodri also becomes the third Premier League player to win the Ballon d'Or after Ronaldo and Michael Owen. And there were a couple reasons, a couple things get taken into consideration. Obviously, it's not his goal scoring or his assisting, which, you know, great for a center defensive mid. But he had one loss in 2024. One.
Yeah, insane.
And that was in the FA Cup final to Ten Hag, which was a huge upset. And you know what? It was kind of like a sleeper agent. Like, you let United win that. They stick with the coach for a while. Everybody wins except United.
Rodri did it on purpose.
Exactly.
He lost that game on purpose to keep Erik ten Hag in Manchester.
That's exactly right. And I mean, there were, like I said, there are so many good players this year that I was genuinely surprised. But I mean, James, Sean, you guys want to go over some of the players that missed out?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the top guy is Vinicius Jr. was the person who was most rumored to be the competition. I would say he finished second, Jude Bellingham in third, Danny Carvajal in fourth, and then obviously another Manchester City player in Erling Haaland in fifth. I think it was really disappointing to see that nobody from Real Madrid attended the ceremony once they found out Vinicius wasn't going to win. I just think that exemplifies the spoiled child behavior we've come to expect from Real Madrid when it doesn't go their way. Mm-hmm. Speaking of not going their way, they got smoked in El Clasico this weekend 4-0. So it's a tough week for all of the Yankees fans out there, if you know what I mean, because you're also probably Real Madrid fans. That's a joke.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I see that connection. It's beautiful. Flawless, really. But I agree with you, Sean. I mean, I don't think if it was as clear-cut or it was going to be a runaway with Vinny Jr., which we all can agree he's got to be one of the best strikers slash wingers in the entire world. End all. That's it. If this was strictly for forwards and wingers, yes, Vinny, congratulations, you get this award. But it can't all be about statistics, right? So obviously Rodri's not putting up the numbers that Vinny is going to be, but he played such an integral role in the World Cup, in the Euros, in Manchester City's doing for years and years and years. And this year was finally the year that it exemplified how important he was. Of course, he had a little stint in there where he choked the guy out last season and got a red card, but we won't talk about that. That was only three games. Regardless, I think one of the big names that for me for this one, talking about El Clasico, is Lamine Yamal. He finished eighth place, which makes him the youngest player to ever secure a top 10 finish at the age of 17. So the youngest player ever. So congratulations. It really is a great talent and star that we'll be talking about for years to come. But for the week that's upcoming, we do have more games midweek, not as exciting as European games, but we are into the round of 16 of the Carabao Cup. And we got a couple big games here, the largest ones being Chelsea versus Newcastle and Man City versus Spurs, both being at home for the London club. So we'll have the Spurs stadium and we'll have Chelsea there. It's very, Pep Guardiola has already come to the music to Kyle's ears and said that we will not be wasting energy on the competition this year, which means for Kyle, he's not going for the triple crown for four. He's not going for a perfect season here. I think based off the fact that they won 1-0 against Southampton, probably a good idea. But another game in there, which is interesting, is Liverpool gets an early sneak peek at Brighton since they also play each other this weekend in the EPL as well. So some Carabao Cup action for you, round of 16. As far as the weekend roundup goes for segment number two, Sean, why don't you take it away with probably one of the most intense and entertaining and definitely entertaining games of the season so far. And real quick, before we tell you who it's with, the score of this game was 4-3, right? So this is 20 for you football lovers out there, American footballer lovers out there, you're looking at 28-21. So most of the football games in our tri-state area, unfortunately, neither of our sporting teams make it to any of those numbers. So for those who think that football is more exciting than soccer, you should watch this game. So Sean, who do we have?
Yeah, this was Brentford Ipswich Town, which was, as you said, the game of the weekend. Seven goals between the two sides and a red card to boot, which you know Kyle loves. That always makes him enjoy the game a little bit more. The Tractor Boys came out of the gates really hot in this game. Two goals in the first half hour, and they looked to be on course for their first Premier League win. But Yohan Wiese and Brian Mbeumo had other ideas. It started off with Wiese scoring on the break twice. Once was actually an own goal, but he basically forced that to happen. To deadlock the scores at halftime. There was a Mbeumo and penalty just after the halftime whistle. But Liam Delap, son of Rory Delap, scored for Ipswich to knot things at 3-3. And unfortunately, not long after that, Harry Clark, who's a defender on Ipswich, who also scored the own goal earlier in the game, was sent off in the 77th minute for a second yellow. It looked like Ipswich was going to hang on for the 3 points, but the Bees were able to sting them in the 6th minute of stoppage time as a wayward Brian Mbeumo cross ended up in the back of the net and gave the Bees all 3 points. Now, obviously, you start up 2-0 and you also draw the game level with 10 minutes to go. You're feeling pretty confident, but if you look at it from an expected goal standpoint, Brentford would comfortably the better team in this game and just didn't take their chances. And Ipswich did, but at the end of the day, ball don't lie.
Yep. I think a special shout out for Mbeumo, right? He's been having a hell of a season so far. Even Wiese, and we highlighted them at the beginning of the season that with with Ivan Toney gone last season and now 100% gone this season, these two have really picked up the pieces of that attacking force for Brentford, and they have not shown signs of slowing down. Obviously, they've only gotten 4 wins out of 9 games with 4 losses, but they're doing extremely, extremely well. You have Mbeumo with 8 goals so far and Wissa with 4. So, you know, Mbeumo's up there in conversation with the Golden Boot at the moment, which is really, really exciting if you're a Brentford fan.
The other thing I was going to say is that there was a little bit of a hat tip from Mbeumo to Ivan Toney with how he took that penalty with the slow skip run up and then making his decision at the last second, which I thought, I don't know if that's something they just teach at Brentford or that's how he takes his penalties now, but I thought it was interesting.
Yeah, the crazy thing is, I mean, he's very, very good. He's only got 2 penalty goals, one of them coming from this game. But when you look at the top scorers of the league so far, you have Erling Haaland with 11. And it's a shocking top of the league, right? You have Brian Mbeumo in second with 8. I know we personally love this one. Chris Wood of Nottingham Forest sits in 3rd place with 7 goals. He got a brace, I believe, over the weekend. And then you have Cole Palmer, which is, that makes a lot of sense here on the top there. He's at 7 as well. Another shocker is Danny Welbeck at 6. He's had a great season so far. And then one I don't think we would have anticipated. I thought he was going to be out of a job by the end of the season. It's Nicholas Jackson. And then you have Mo Salah right there, which is typical. And then, of course, your boy Liam Delap, which is
cool. Nico Jackson, though. I mean, he's getting gifted goals. Mm. I mean, if you watch his goal this weekend, that was all Palmer. That ball from Palmer was a gift down the wing. And then it was a tapping goal.
Yeah.
I hate fuck Nico.
Yeah, but I mean, he still had to beat Burns to get into the center of the pitch, but we digress. One thing that I know we are going to talk in length about is the next game that we've highlighted here, and that's Arsenal 2, Liverpool 2 at the Emirates Stadium. So with the week preview last week that we did with this, I know Sean was feeling a little bit more confident than I was. Of course, that was with the knowledge that at the moment, Saka and Timber were both going to be out. Obviously, at the start of this game, at the beginning, an hour before the game kicked off, we did see the lineup and Saka was playing on the right side and Timber was in as well, which was a great confident boost for me. Still not as confident. I still felt that, you know, the game was going to be difficult once again. But Sean, you have it here, a tale of two halves. I don't think you can say it much better. We've always said that Arsenal comes out of the blocks and stifles teams. And I've always said that Liverpool comes back out at that halftime talk and really picks up the pace on that second half. And that's exactly what you had. I think Arsenal were by far the dominant force in the first half. Within the first 9 minutes, you had a beautiful goal by Bukayo Saka, who was passed over the top, that got past Andy Robertson through a Ben White over the top ball playing at the center back. So that was a very, very impressive goal to score within the 10-minute mark, which opened the goal scoring of the evening, and also has Saka now with his 50th Premier League goal, which is now, I believe, he's the youngest player of Arsenal history to get to the 50 career Premier League goals as well. But Sean, what do you think overall for this game? And then we can get into the specifics. So I have a couple people I want to highlight, but what did you think, or what was your major takeaways from this game?
A few things. So first of all, like you said, I think Arsenal dominated this first half in particular. After Van Dijk scored to equalize off that Luis Diaz flick, I was like, great, let's just get into the half 1-1, especially as that half progressed from there. I think he scored around the 20th minute, mm-hmm. and Arsenal really had a lot of chances from there. They won a bunch of free kicks and on corners. And I was like, we cannot keep giving them set piece opportunities because we know how dangerous they are. Obviously, Gabriel was hurt in this game. That I think happened later on, but
correct.
He's such a menace at free kicks. You cannot just constantly give them opportunities. They talk about Nicolas Javert every single week, the set piece coach for Arsenal. And
I think he gets more airtime than Arteta at this point. It's wild.
Let's not get too hasty here. But the one thing that was a little insane to me was how much that guy was bigging himself up, because the ball in from Declan Rice to score the goal was superb. Like, just an absolutely gorgeous ball. I don't think Nicolas Javert can get credit for Declan Rice having a peach of a pass. No. That's just me. It's a little crazy of me, I know, but
I think Arsenal had earlier in the match, they had the exact same play, same location. They all go towards the back post in an offsides position and quickly run when the kicker is about to kick it onto an onside position at that back line towards the center and try to then carry their run back towards the goal. But surprise, surprise, actually Mikel Merino was at the end of that first ball by Declan Rice as well, which was also a peach of a ball, but didn't finish. So, I mean, it's just an incredible set piece that they've used multiple times. It's not like they're really changing anything up too much. They've been doing that same play for quite a bit. So it's not like he's got this, you know, playbook where he's holding up a pink flag on the sideline for this one, a yellow flag for this one. Like there's no real rhyme or reason to it. But of course it was a fantastic ball by Declan Rice.
I actually think it'd be kind of dope if they start doing the college football play card thing, though, where they just have like five different things. Like, oh, this is the set piece play we're running this time.
Yep.
But in terms of other takeaways I had from the game, I think the weakness of Andy Robertson was kind of exposed in this game. Saka had him on strings. The first goal was top notch from Saka. Like I said on the notes here, it reminded me a lot of the goal Mo Salah scored against Arsenal at Anfield last year, with the game I was at where the ball was played over the top and then he just turns the left back inside out, Zinchenko, gets it onto his dominant left foot and smashes it near post.
Yep.
But I think that's a big issue. You look around at Manchester City, right? They have Yasko Guardiol, who's a center back. He's now moved to left back. He's really composed on the ball. He can hit shots from deep. He's tremendous 1v1 defender. You look at Arsenal, they have both Timber and Calafiori who can play that role. Liverpool's not upgraded on Andy Robertson for 7 or 8 years now, and I think his legs are starting to go, and he doesn't have the physicality of the three guys that I just mentioned. I think that's the area that Liverpool should be looking to upgrade most definitely in the next transfer window, if not in the summer.
Yeah.
Because I think that's the one obvious weakness of this team, and Arsenal attacked it in the first half. 44% of their attacks came down their right side, Liverpool's left.
Yep.
So Havertz did a good job of pulling Van Dijk into space and then creating isolated matchups for Saka, which he took advantage of for that first goal and created other opportunities as well going forward.
Yeah. I think on the opposite side of the pitch, when you're looking at the Arsenal's left side attacking down that left wing with pace with Martinelli, who had a relatively good game. I think, unfortunately, he had towards the end a bit tired legs, which ultimately led up to to Liverpool's counterattack goal. He lost possession very back. I have to give a big shout out Konate, who played extremely well in the center back position next to Virgil van Dijk. Every time Martinelli got the possession and sprinted towards Trent Alexander-Arnold, who he gave a hard time last season, that is Martinelli, Konate was right there as backup and did really well and essentially was the main reason why Liverpool scored their second goal, won the ball off of him. He provided additional coverage for Trent Alexander-Arnold, and you guys quickly made a counter up the pitch. So great work from there. Obviously, this wasn't a 100% healthy Arsenal team, but the way that they played and came out flying, like Mikel Arteta said, was definitely something that I was very happy to see. Obviously, splitting points with Liverpool home is a difficult game or result to take and be extremely happy about, but Liverpool's top three. Liverpool has only lost one game the entire season so far, so I'm definitely happy. I will say I owe one Thomas Partey a huge, huge apology. This man had an incredible game at right back, and I said last week, if Thomas Partey is right back, I would throw a sharp object and hope that it hit an innocent bystander. I fully take that back. I would go happily to jail overnight for that happening, but Thomas Partey did a really, really great job. Other than the one nutmeg that Luis Diaz did, even on both sides, right, of fullbacks, kept Mo Salah quiet for the majority of the game until we had a substitute because of Timber's injury, which we brought in another, I believe, 17-year-old with Lewis Miles Scully, who's been doing very, very well, who's been getting a lot of time so far with Mikel Arteta. And then, of course, with Jakub Kivior, who came in for the injured Gabriel early into the second half. He had a relatively good performance, but just having those two younger and not as experienced center back and left back in the game, you knew that something was going to happen with Mo Salah. And of course, he capitalized and brought home a point for Liverpool.
Yeah, for sure. I think the one note I had on that was just that, first of all, I don't think Timber makes any impact on that goal. It's an unbelievable pass from Trent from deep. Puts a two-on-one situation. Great pass from Darwin. I don't think it matters who the left back is there. I think that's just individual quality on display on that one. Mm-hmm. It makes Mo the highest goal scorer in the Arsenal-Liverpool fixture. And only Wayne Rooney, 12, and Harry Kane, 14, have more goals against the Gunners than Mohamed Salah. Just another week, another record. I think he moved into ninth place now on the all-time Premier League goal scoring charts.
I think it was eight.
And my last... Oh, it's eight. I think sorry. It's eight. Apologies, Mo. My bad. And the last note I had is the fact that these teams don't play each other again until May 10th, which potentially could be an enormous game at Anfield, the third to last game of the season. Kind of wild. I was listening to the Athletics podcast and they said that today. I was like, wow, that game is going to be enormous.
Yeah, that's crazy. Oh boy, I didn't realize that either. So that will be really fun. That's match week 36 of 38. So that's insane. But we're going to take a quick break and breather from this weekend's games. And when we come back, we're going to go straight into rapid kicks and into segment number four, which is our look ahead. So give us 2 minutes and we'll be right back.
So one of the most difficult things about preparing for this episode is trying to figure out what games we wanted to talk about because there were so many good ones this weekend. One of the ones that I saw that I thought was fantastic was Brighton Wolves, which was ended in a 2-2 game. Wolves had an incredible 2-goal comeback in the dying embers of this game to get their second point of the season and to move out of the bottom spot. If you haven't seen it, go look at the game tying goal. Brighton has a 4-on-1 opportunity against Wolves' central midfielder, picks off the pass, plays it to Cunha. Cunha goes all the way down the field and scores to tie it. Place goes absolutely berserk. I think that was one of my favorite moments of this weekend. But Kyle, talk to me about a weekend that definitely made our friend James happy.
Oh, it sure did. Tottenham lost 1-0 to Crystal Palace in the first match of the season between the two. Eagles soared to their first victory. I cannot believe I just said that. Fuck the Eagles. The Crystal Palace has won for the first time this season, downing the Spurs at Selhurst Park, thanks to a resounding Jean-Philippe Mateta finish.
Yeah, he's been quiet for the majority of the season. Eddie Nketiah came in with obviously his transfer at the summer. Mateta did replace Eddie in this match and finally found, I believe it's his first or second goal of the season. So definitely a game that made me happy off of the scoreline. Definitely did not see that one coming. If you were to guess who was going to win that game 9 out of 10 times, I would have said Spurs, especially in this current form. But quick shout out to Eparije Eze. He had a phenomenal back heel or flick rather for the goal. So if you haven't checked that out, that's probably the assist. Well, I mean, this weekend was, like Sean said, this weekend was full of incredible assists and balls, but this one was one of the best probably out there. Moving on to the next one we have here, almost a scoreline that I think everyone would have been really happy with, but it just kind of ended 1-0, is Manchester City 1, Southampton 0. Erling Haaland showed off his incredible strength to score the only goal of the match 5 minutes into the game. So the rest of the game was relatively uneventful, but I think if you're Southampton, you walk away relatively happy that you didn't get absolutely trounced on. So a very good game for Southampton there.
So moving right on, we got Aston Villa Bournemouth. Evan Nielsen scored a stoppage time header off a free kick to steal the Cherries a point against another top table side. This is humongous, guys. Bournemouth is playing unbelievable. If you would have told me they get 4 points out of their fixtures against Arsenal and Aston Villa, I would have told you you're high on something.
Yeah,
that is very impressive way to finish October and get into the winter months where the pickup, I mean, there's a lot more games you're going to be playing. But one notable thing from not the game, but Emi Martinez, congratulations, one of my favorite players in the world. He won the Yashin Award for best goalkeeper. I think it's extremely deserved for everything he's done. And it's just topped off with the Copa. He's done it all. Love the guy.
One of the more exciting games of the weekend as well, not only because we had a couple goals chalked off, a couple VARs, a couple reviews. It had it all kind of. It was Chelsea 2, Newcastle 1. So if you watch this game, it was a very entertaining game, a lot of back and forth. It was a lot of blow for blow. And I watched this one. It was relatively entertaining, in my opinion. But the Blues do get back on the right track, especially at home with their first or second win at Stamford Bridge. I believe it was their first win at Stamford Bridge in the Premier League season thus far, with the partnership, again, of Nicholas Jackson and Cole Palmer. Cole Palmer really being the catalyst for everything at the game again, really, really becoming cold Palmer as he is. And Newcastle lose their second straight match. And I believe they're actually winless in their past five now. So a bit of a stifling issue for Newcastle United, who will go right into the next segment, go against Arsenal at St. James's Park this weekend. So another one, obviously, here we have, you know, you say the site of another one of my freakouts when Newcastle kicked, you know, nicked really a 1-0 victory over the Gunners last season, thanks to some questionable VAR decision-making, meaning was the ball out of bounds? Did Gabriel really foul or get fouled? This one was all over the place. St. James Park is a very difficult location to go and play at, but this is our second away game of six away games in seven games, so we're not going to be home for a while. We got five, I believe we got five away games in a row, then we're home, and then we go one more away. So a lot of away games with the next seven. And we have a spell of Inter after Newcastle. We have Chelsea after that. We have Sporting CP, who we just talked about. And then we have West Ham all away coming up. But this will be a close game, I hope. And I think Arsenal will come away with this one, though, with Newcastle's current form.
Yeah, I think there was more analysis of that game last year than there has been of the Zapruder film of JFK's assassination. So we don't need to talk about it too much. But like you said, five games without a win for Newcastle. Are they due? Question mark. People are asking. Speaking of teams that are due, two teams coming off of disappointing results, Spurs and Aston Villa at Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. In terms of importance, I think this tops the list in the Premier League this weekend. Both of these teams competed for the fourth spot last year. Obviously, Villa was the team that ended up being victorious on that front. Interesting fact about this game. So this game, like I said, is in North London. Last season, the visiting team won each of the games. So it was a 2-1 victory at Tottenham Hotspur Stadium for Villa. And then Spurs, if you might remember, smoked Villa at Villa Park. It gave them their first loss of the season there with a 4-0 victory. Villa obviously have been flying in Europe. They're top of the Champions League phase at the moment. But they do have three draws in their last five matches. So I'm going to lean towards Spurs in this one, especially because I expect that Son will be back for this game. But I do expect it'll also be a very evenly matched, a good game. And Villa, for once, don't have a midweek game. They already are out of the Carabao Cup, and there's no Champions League this week.
Yeah, Spurs do have, like we mentioned, a midweek game against City. So that could have a little bit of an impact on based off of health and who's going to be readily available. But I think this one, especially since it's at Spurs Stadium, will be a very close game. And it's not like Villa's been blowing anyone out of the water either. They've been leaving a lot of their games very late. And we know Spurs likes to leave things late, and they tend to finish a bit strong too. So this one could be full of firecrackers towards the end of the evening. And then finally, we have one more here. Kyle, you want to take Manchester United versus Chelsea?
I would love to. All right, Chelsea. Only won once in the last eight trips to Old Trafford, but the most recent was last year with Cole Palmer having a brace. So it should be a good one. I know Sean is our king of coaches. Do you think that they have a new manager bounce potentially at Old Trafford?
It's tough for me to see them getting a result right now, but yeah, maybe a little bit more of an engaged crowd at Old Trafford does lift them. I think Van Nistelrooy will probably be the coach for this one, and then Amorim will come in following that, but I don't know. I still kind of lean towards Chelsea. I think they have more individual quality, and obviously they're a little bit more cohesive with Maresca in charge. But we've seen the new manager bounce, take hold, and good teams fall victim to it several times. So that's definitely one to watch as well. That's the primetime kickoff, according to NBC, the 11:30 on Sunday afternoon or Sunday morning.
I think that one will be very intense to watch. I do think Chelsea pulls away with this one again. Like you said, Sean, they're in good form. They have talent all across the pitch. They have talent on the bench now. I mean, you look at Christopher Nkunku, who came in on the weekend. He came off the bench, looked great. I think you just have so many options with Chelsea. It's a very difficult team at this point to really to bet against, in my opinion. But if you were a betting man, betting on the APL Fantasy League, and you were betting on the first place team, which was Graham Hewitt's, I believe, was it?
Toss
My Sala, right? Yeah. Undefeated until one of my dear friends, college teammate, Trevor Salaz, ends the tyranny, ends the inevitable, which was Graham Hewitt. He handed him his, he won last season, and he was handed his first Premier League loss in our league this season. So well done, Trev. Thank you very much. I know, Sean, you have here, ding dong, the witch is dead, in the spirit of Halloween. No offense, Graham, obviously. You are doing a killer job so far. Congratulations last year again. But God, we got to get some competition here. Speaking of that competition, though, Sean, you and I are looking pretty good, man. We're top, what, six, I think? We're right there. So not too far off the pace. Not too far off the pace.
Kyle drew? I didn't even know you could draw on this. That's the first time I'm realizing this was possible. It just, each week, you just continue to impress me. I absolutely bludgeoned your brother. I guess poor fantasy performance runs in the family. But Kyle, what do you have to say for yourself, man? You weren't here for our segment last week.
I'm devastated. It's awful. It's absolutely awful. For those who live in the States, you know what a tie does. I mean, if you watch football, it ruins your season. You're done. You're feathers. How pathetic. So it's just not a good look. It's 1-1-7 now on the season.
I'm sorry. Am I not supposed to laugh at that? That's fucking hysterical.
Maybe to you, but you know what? We're going to come back. We're playing a big match this week. It's going up against one of the top dogs. I believe it's going to be against... God, I did all this research about this game. Keep going.
I'll look it up.
Brian Chiaraca. Brian, my friend, prepare for devastation. I'm just letting you know. All bars are being pulled. I am going to start a full lineup this week, no doubt about it. And I will be choosing captains very wisely. So watch out. You better work on that lineup, man. It's coming.
Diabolical pronunciation of Chiaraca, so shout out to Kyle for that one. That's my cousin Brian, who is also known as the Reese Nelson Stan to James. That's how I always refer to him. He and I were going back and forth this morning about the Arsenal-Liverpool match and how the goal, or not goal, whatever you want to call it, the whistle that was blown right at the end of the game.
We didn't talk about that. I don't know why we didn't talk about that. That's wild.
Because there was nothing to talk about, dude. There was two different fouls and a handball, and you guys scored after the whistle was blown. But other than that, yeah.
Well, after the whistle was blown, I guess the whistle should never have been blown. But we missed our opportunity to discuss that, obviously. But yeah, I'm looking now, Sean. I'm going week by week, trying to figure out when we face off or if we face off each other.
While James figures that out, gentlemen, I'm going to tell you exactly who to start this week. It's going to be Leif Davis. And here's the reason, gentlemen.
Shocker. Whoa, again. Whoa, 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 again.
Yeah, that was me week four. I chose him as well. But here's the thing, guys. He's at home going up against Leicester. This is going to be their first win of the season. It's going to be massive, and they're going to shut them out. It's going to be a 1-0 victory at home. And that's 6 points for my boy Leif Davis. It's a clean sheet, 90 minutes played. You already know. He might even get a goal or an assist. Like, it's going to be fantastic, guys. He's cheap.
Well, bold. All right. Well, we'll see if that pays off for you, Kyle. It did pay off for you last time, I believe. We've been doing relatively well with our recommendations. Of course, I think, Sean, last week, who did you say? Mbeumo? You said drop.
No.
Not last week. You said Mbeumo earlier in the season.
Last week. But Mbeumo was earlier in the year. I did captain Mbeumo last week, which panned out wonderfully for me. And then I also had Salah and Palmer just...
Sean, you were the top dog this week, right?
Is that good? Is 90 points good?
I don't know. I don't know what it feels like to score that.
Yep. Well, I found it. If for all you who are obviously going to be marking your calendars for this, week 20 is when Slots Soldiers face off against Hotel Calafiori. So mark it down.
Ice up, son.
Do what you got to do. So it's going to be great. It's going to be great. Well, everybody, that does conclude our episode for this evening and or morning. I don't know when you listen. I do care very heavily. Let me know. Are you listening to it in the shower because our voices really do bring you happiness? Or are you listening to it on your way to work because you want to start off your day superbly? Doesn't matter to me. We love you. Thank you for the support as always, and enjoy the midweek games and weekend. And we will talk to you on Monday next week. Thank you very much. EPL State of Mind, signing off.